tap ourselves over here since we haven't got a quorum or anything. So I use the other end of the gavel, so we're sort of going to talk about this bill. We will talk about it, but it's good you're here. And this will be a private little screening for you all to hear what's in the bill and a few points about it. And I want to thank the staff who have come and the one member who's checked in besides me being here. And the loyal lobbyist. Oh, here comes Laura Brad. So we're moving along here. My intention for the people at home, there's way more people listening at home, I think, thank goodness, we were thinking we were going to try to vote this out today. That's not going to happen for a lot of reasons. What's that?
Do I get to make that decision then, Mr. Chuck?
You want to not do it today?
No, I mean, since we're the only ones who are here to vote.
Representative Brad has concerns about voting it out today, so therefore we're not going to vote it out today. What we're going to do is to try to vet this bill out here more as opposed to having to go through health and commerce and do most of the work there in those two committees and wherever else it winds up. It seems to be given the fact that we're past deadline anyway, which I had actually expected, that it makes little sense to let it forge our way ahead into committees that are going to be doing other things. And then when we're ready to go, we can have either some kind of meeting with those two groups and whoever else just has to go visit. After having dealt with the issues that are in front of us about the bill. So that's my... I think we'll be meeting again on Thursday. I don't know just what time. At this point, it's kind of set for after session, at which point we'll take... if people want to come up and offer public comments about it, then they may. I'm assuming open to private comments, and I do intend to try to find some consensus points here. If you didn't like how I treated your group about this thing... then I hope that feels too bad, although if it's certain groups, I can get, I think that's kind of funny, but because some of these things are just there to get people to be paying attention to the bill, and they're going to come out today. There's a couple technical errors we're going to address, and so that's that. I believe you've all got copies of the bill. There's summaries available from Randy, and there's an outside chance we might be here during the committee hour on Thursday, if they're not using that time. That's yet to be determined. So we'll try to keep it humane for you. At the end of the day, things I know are hard on people's families, including mine. That all being said, I'll just walk you through page by page, as a matter of fact, and we're going to... Glad the plans are getting here. You guys got watches or anything? Or? We're on Blue Cross time today. It's a... Welcome. Yeah, just go, and we're glad you're here too. Anyway, the first there's some things you've seen before, and I think that you shouldn't be too surprised at what you found in the bill. Every topic that was in here was listed in the ideas. If you would have read my chairman's proposals, you would have found every item in there. There were numbers of things that were taken out because they frankly it had too many people didn't like them. They were all wonderful ideas. Anyway, the first section of the bill is this M-share business. We allow it to raise the prices to represent more what normal is. However, this still does not get anywhere near recognizing the cost. This is a Bradley provision from House File 2. Section number 2, which is on page 4, is a small employer flexible benefits plan, and the author suggests I don't put it in my bill, so this is going to come out of my bill. So I was trying to do him a favor, give it a piggyback ride. Show some enthusiasm for it. It's a wonderful provision, but not for today. So just keeping track of this, Randy or Tom, that would be a deletion in my author's amendment to take out Section 2. Section 3 is a small charges, no prior authorization thing. And let me explain that. There's just to back up, if you read Dernberger's work and you read all the people's work, they talk about transparency, who's getting the money, disclose who has what interest where, and also some of the built-in costs, which I've coined and made the term cost fiction, are a real problem. I happen to be privileged to belong to a managed care group, and the reimbursement rate on a particular service I provide them is $21.78. Which, by the way, is below my cost, if they're listening. Anyway, so people come in with a copay of $20. And I fill out a 4-page report, and we have to track it. We send it in, they tell us how much we can get, So I can get $1.78. Now, I don't know how much they're paying on their end to process this report. I know they're paying somebody something. To have us exchange $1.78 is total lunacy. And I call it cost friction. There is no inhibiting effect on the system about those $1.78. And all of it, I would expect that we're putting in $5 or $6 on my end worth of stuff to comply with this group's requirements. And I got to think the plan is putting in more than that to track this little bill. And then they have to send up the check. And they have to send write the check. And then they have to have somebody bank, you know, and there's a bank. It's like, and so this is the reason for that idea. And if somebody would incur a few extra $1.78 charges in the grand scheme of costs, it would not matter. It would actually lower costs to remove the burden on these little dinky claims that don't make sense. That's the idea, and I'm willing to have testimony about that later. It's meant to be friendly. Section 4 is that what I tried also, you'll see a lot of my wonderful ideas I thought the clients might want to do. I made them ideas I didn't tell them they had to in the original draft, if you saw that, or in the original proposal, but I was... what I'm trying to get at is I think we do too much testing to no end. I think that a dear person comes in the clinic to for some concern about something and they're convinced it's a brain tumor and it's just and it's not, and the doctor can tell you it's not. If they were paying for it, they wouldn't get one, but they're insisting on getting it, and or they're worried about something else, and the clinician has no indication that it's the thing that they're going to test for, and yet they test for it. And it comes back, lo and behold, it's not that thing. And so you spent $500, $1,000, $2,000 for what could have waited a day or two to see if it would have got any better. And so I'm suggesting that we develop some... We're all about evidence-based medicine. I think that the system is moving into that. The corollary of that is medical necessity. And so I don't want to hamper emergency testing. I don't want to have anybody die over this or suffer harm. I am all for quality, and you know, I don't mind mandates, so I'm not trying to even get rid of any quality in this thing, but I think there's some tests that just don't make sense. And if there could be some protocols devised that people who actually know about their particular regimen of care, and I think some of the plans are doing this anyway, that I would encourage them in that. At the same time, I don't favor rationing. And we want to have access, and there's a balance where you go, and it needs to be in the middle. So that's the point of that. And then Section 5 is this health card thing. And this is a provider-level thing, and some of these things are minor and little, and they make some kind of numerous, and some are like major. This is a minor thing, but in my little clinic, we try to do a public service and call everybody's plans. Well, some of the plans, actually, you can go online, or they call them, there's actually somebody getting the phone. And you can find out in a matter of 2 minutes. But on some of them, especially some of the self-insured plans, the ERISA plans, they have, and you know, the Medicare, you know, health partners of Blue Cross, and there's kind of a normal package that they have. In the self-insured, you just don't know what they got. They have maybe a $2,000 deductible, and then it's managed to somebody, and they're paying cash until they get to a number. You don't know what to tell them. And so this would simply be a way to make it easier for the person at the desk. This wouldn't help the patients at all. This would help the provider to know that this is a Minnesota plan. It's under Minnesota law that you would expect it. It's one of those as compared to the other. It wouldn't cost... We're not going to make you put out new cards with this. Just that when you put the card out, just write that on the bottom in some code. That's the idea of that. Section 6 is the Knobloch bill with a few tweaks. This is the purchasing pools where small employers, I think it was small employers, can enter in. Also, what I'm trying to do in another theme is to create a market. And I'm sympathetic to the teachers' issues, and I'm trying to find some ways to help out some of their stuff. The teachers know I'm uncomfortable with the mandatory feature of theirs. I like voluntary, I like market-driven, and this is not a surprise to them. So, some of the innovations that are going on, and this is there's no criticism in any of these ideas about any plans that are currently in operation. I see there's a lot of innovation going on everywhere, and I try to, in my best ways, based upon their urgings especially, to stay out of the way of the innovation. I see some innovation happening. Some of the most exciting ones are where these little you know, PT boats are kind of exciting. They dart all about, you know, the big battleship, which is, you know, and a lot of our plans are stable and they're moving along and they have lots of things going on. And many of these little PT boats, some of these little service co-ops that have done some very innovative things. And I think that we need some of all. And the idea of this was, if you do the Knobloch idea, which was to allow the employers to buy into these things, it might give some more opportunities for people to have, in the, especially in the self-insured market. I don't see this eroding anything to do with the Minnesota plans. I see the self-insured market as an area that needs to be some help, and you'll see later on some other ideas about that. This would be, yes.
Do you want us to hold questions?
I was going to clarify that. No, go ahead. Yeah.
A couple of us to hold questions until the end, or do you want to be asked along the way? What's your preference?
Whatever you like. Do you have a question?
Well, I do.
Okay. So go back a ways?
Well, no, I have a couple questions backwards that I can wait and we can actually move forward. In regards to the Knobloch bill, I don't recall the idea that they have to be in there for a minimum period of time, and then if they leave, they could be fined. And maybe I'm either reading that wrong or didn't understand that piece of the bill, but what if somebody has a job...
This is actually a longer version of the bill.
Okay.
This wasn't quite long enough.
What if somebody has a job that is part of the pool, and then they choose to take a job that is not part of that pool or has different health care benefits set? Do they then need to pay a penalty to get out of the pool, or are they automatically dropped out because they're not designated as a member?
Well,
this
is about the employer. This isn't about the individual member. An employer joins these pools, a school district person joins the pools and the schools, and the members, teachers come and go, and they can come and go as they like. But when an employer leaves, I believe in the service clubs, they lose their reserves because they stay with the co-op. Is that right, Tom?
They face a penalty of some kind.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
And so
that's the clarification I needed. We're not talking about the people within the pools. We're talking about the employer
itself.
Right. Perfect.
And just to know what I did there, is I understood they lost their reserves. What I want to have, you can't have people jumping in and out of pools all the time. But if you create a reason, if you create a competitive market, people might have reason to move on a periodic basis for reasons of good competition, which keeps everybody's pencils sharper, which is how I define the market. And so this way they don't lose their reserves, they just have to get them over time. So that way the pool is not harmed, and they'll have reasons to keep you in, and they'll be driven to service. But that way the employer would not find themselves having lost their reserves altogether. So they would, and if this goes forward, and I kind of hope it does, there needs to be a way to kind of risk adjust them as they come in. If they've had bad experience and they're leaving their addiction to somebody who is charging high rates, then they need to kind of find a way to, they're a high risk group, and so they have to be kind of risk adjusted coming in so they can, you know, be treated so you can't hurt the pool. And this is all beyond the scope of this description.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
In regards to the pool on page 7, line 22 and 23, it talks about a refund be paid over a period of 5 years. Where does that number come from?
I just made it up. I thought it was a reasonable time. It's a 20% per year they get back in from their reserves. So I believe under the co-ops they lost it. I thought this was better than losing it.
Mm-hmm.
So they wouldn't want to walk away. And I don't think people should be trapped any place. They should be able to come and go, and the market should allow that. And that's my. I'm sure there'll be some testimony about that, which we'll hear from maybe on Thursday. Is that clear enough about that?
Good. Thank you.
Yeah. And I want to make a comment here too. This committee, this division, has been a little different than what you're accustomed to. If you didn't notice that already, but this is a. If there's good ideas in here, but they need to have a little help, please help me make them into a better idea, or at least an idea that's not got fatal flaws in it. I hope that we don't go for or against things based upon a misunderstanding I have about something, or that someone's stuck in there from a bill they have. We really have to find a way to create a better market and create more transparency and help it to be better. So for the sake of the employers who are being sunk by their prices, and employees who were driven away from raises because of what they have to pay, we have to find a solution. And so I am amongst the most interested in your comments of anybody around. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I do have another question. I do prefer to go forward, but I have one going backwards. But on page 5, lines 1 and 2, we just passed out
we took
a
out.
Bill. Oh, you did.
Section 2 has been taken out. The whole, that's the welcome bill.
Okay, so that's no longer...
It's not here. He doesn't want it in here, so I was like, here's the...
Okay, I'm sorry. All right, thank you.
Okay. So that was exactly the... that's exactly how we passed it.
Okay.
Thank you for asking. And so, anyway, so this pool thing appeals to me, and so if there's somewhere to go with that, just help me on fatal flaws. Any questions about the pool thing? Staff and members? We're on section 7 now. If section 7 is on page 8, this is a discount card, and let me explain to you why I thought of that. I understand that I cannot give you a discount at my clinic unless I have some good reason to do it. I can perhaps give you a discount for cash, some reasonable amount, but I can't just give you a discount because you asked for one. If I do give you a discount for no reason, how can I bill an auto insurer or a Blue Cross or Medica the price that I say is my price? And so, but if you join a club, you're part of a negotiated agreement with me as part of a group of somebody who's got power to do that, I can honor the request of that group. For instance, Blue Cross has a pre-negotiated price with the group I'm in, and they pay us whatever I agree that they're going to pay, and I take that as payment in full. What this is designed to do is to avoid the issue of fraud, and to allow for some of this these uninsureds to have at least some ability to go shopping, and to help the provider get payment same day of service for the price, even maybe better than what Blue Cross pays. Without, and that's not a slam, but it may be at least comparable to what Blue Cross pays, having gone through all the insurance business and filling out forms and filling out the dollar. It's not a Blue Cross $1.78 thing, by the way, just so you know. So again, you're the great carrier. So, but so without all the paperwork and all the muss. And so what this says is that Commerce or some other worthy entity would create these cards. And so for $25, you can be a lifetime member of the Minnesota Buying Club. And you can take this card and go to anybody who wants to accept it, any provider in the state, whether it be an ER or a pharmacist or a chiropractor or an orthodontist, whoever. And this provider will offer from 0 to 25% discount for using this card. And I will tell you, most people go to 25 because that's the number that makes sense, given the reductions on the usual and customary that most of the plans provide, and the ease of having cash at the time of service without any billing. And so that's the idea of that. And there's no overhead with this thing. You just provide the card, the people go shop, and some will probably generate a list someday about who has these, who will accept the cards, but they'll have to provide if they will or won't, and they'll establish a number they're going to have in their clinic as the discount price. And it's a way to help the uninsured. And if an auto carrier even, which doesn't have negotiated discounts, would tell their people that they would reimburse them for the prices they would pay, they could reimburse the individual the price they actually paid. And so the provider would give them a receipt and a diagnosis, and then they would send it themselves, and it actually would reduce cost if they would do it that way, and that's would be acceptable. That's how far this could go. Under Blue Cross and other plans where you're supposed to bill on behalf of those folks, that would not be something you could do with them, because that's all. You can't tell them what they owe till the bill comes. Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I'm very interested in the idea behind what you're doing. How do you envision this working in metro areas versus more rural areas? Because I can understand the competition argument and the shopping argument, saying, you know, you can use that card and shop around, because there might be clinics that would choose, because it's voluntary, choose to have it. But in a more rural area where there may be one option, how do you envision something like that working best in that setting?
This is for uninsured in particular. I'll just tell you, the usual customary reductions, like medical assistance, if you have that, they wind up paying 30 to 40% of your price, the price you get in medical assistance in Minnesota Care. It's just a huge discount. The general plans pay in the 60 range, 65, 70 if you're lucky. It just depends. And so that's the reimbursement price anyway of what they're going to get. So they don't have to do it, but this is, they could do it enough, and so they don't have to do it. But it the person might not go in, you know, and in rules they'll take it or not take it, and it's a voluntary deal. You can't make them do it, otherwise it's a mandate and it's burdensome. So if they're in their interest, they'd do it. If they wouldn't, so, yeah. What's your
Sanderson? Mr. Chair, would there be any complications from a legal standpoint on this, or has this been really reviewed legally?
Fairly scrutinized, not a bit, no. Well, just, you know, some, right now, you can, there's a as long as I understand, having been in practice 26 years and been offered a chance to join these various groups who go around, and for a fee, they'll sell you a chance to be in this buying group. And it's a pre-negotiated thing, and it's, you're part of a group, and it's not just some guy coming in. And so I would, there may be some details to mark up on this, how you make sure it's legal and all, and maybe some plan has to offer it so it's a bona fide thing, or, you know, somebody who's got standing can offer these cards. It's an idea, though, and but I'm trying to bring my view of the private sector, you know, just the provider, to something and tell them if there's room there. And so what otherwise happens is this cash person comes in and pays 100%. You know? And you're not really allowed properly to give them a discount.
Yeah, and also, I've had people question that this year, that if they don't have insurance, they end up paying the 100%.
Exactly.
And so something that could be done within the legal framework to help them out would probably be beneficial.
And I expect that in a few days, someone will tell me where the gaps are here and where to fix them, or the thing will blow up. So that's the point of you all are offering, listening today so politely, and then people weighing in. Any more questions? Let's keep moving on. I want to get you out of here by 6 is my goal, so. There's a party tonight, and you also have kids and stuff at home and other things. This number 8, I think, is just a general health plan companies. Just a little disclosure, you know, if there's anything too controversial here for the health plan companies, and you know who you are, tell me how I put your feelings. I just want to confess to one thing, though. I believe, in my mind, in my view, that the money that is put into pre-authorizations is not medical expense. That's not giving any service out. That's an administrative cost, and so I'm stuck on that idea. Convincing otherwise, but I just want to know, I don't even care if you hit, I think it was some target of 10% you're supposed to, I don't care what your admin is. If we want to change the law to make your admin be 50%, I don't care. But as a fair market, what your admin is going to make is going to be important to buyers. And this is especially important for employers. Some things are important to patients, like the little card is important to a patient who wants to go around and shop, who wants to find a doctor he can afford to go to. This is important to employers to know what they're getting, I think. And that's the idea of this, and it's meant to be friendly and not too onerous. And so I'm sure I'll hear about that. Number 10. And any questions about 9? Section 10 is on page 10. This has to do with medication therapy management. And I don't know why every plan doesn't do this anyway. And I do have a reputation for having people do things that are good ideas. You know, different, wonderful, like hearing aids for kids born deaf and all that, and making a law about it. Just so you know, in the state, when I did this test, I have this bill and under MA, this saves the state money. There's a fiscal savings that's substantial about doing this face-to-face, paying pharmacists to sit down and do it. And if at the end of the day it would be something I ask you to look into it and consider offering it as a service, I don't think you do it. But I think it's something that we're missing. And I think as we look forward into the world of modern, as the next 5 and 10, 20 years out, the pharmacists are going to be leaving the business of counting and putting things in the bottles. They'll be doing more of this. This is their best talent. And they're going to save lives, reduce drug costs, and prevent great harm from happening to the people who are under the skill, under the, as they, this is where they could well go. And the system would be better for it, and it's kind of a cost friction, the quality friction thing that I think, and because what happens is the good medical person, doctor, gives them a prescription thinking they're going to take it, doesn't know that they're busy, and they may not know that they're seeing 3 doctors. And then the schedule they have to keep up, and some of the plans are in, and maybe they're a salaried employee, and they have to kind of keep going. They don't have time to, they don't have electronic records. If they're a smaller clinic, they wouldn't know. And so, that's my preaching about this, but I think this has just got huge potential. And in a way to both, to do to better quality at lower cost, I don't know where the win isn't there. So, Representative Sanderson, you're going to be waving your pen at me.
I would just be interested in hearing from the physicians in regarding this section. And I assume we'll do that on Thursday?
The table's in the open. Jason's taking appointments. 396-5813.
Mr.
Alright. Yeah. Welcome.
Thank you. Sorry. I had another committee.
Oh, yeah.
We all do. what is on Thursday?
Oh, we're going to meet again Thursday.
To pass this.
To talk about it some more. Okay. We're not going to pass it very soon.
Oh, are we amending it at all?
Sure.
Okay.
Do you have an idea? I have some author's amendments. I'm going to just back up to the members who are
signing
here. Right. That's fine. It's the last deadline day. Let me just back up to the plan here for some of the other audience members who are late for good reasons.
Okay.
The intention was we were going to mark this up today and move it out. It wasn't ready in time for a Thursday meeting, which was my original plan. I was hoping to review it like this on Thursday, give a weekend to have people comment, maybe meet Monday, talk some more about it, move it out today. Well, none of that happened. And now we're in the throes of our health omnibus. And so it's not a good time to move this into the health committee anyway. And so we'll take advantage of this law in the policy world to take advantage of that time here. So we're going to meet a few times, as many times it takes to kind of vet out these issues. I have people tell me where I'm totally wrong, tell me where I'm right. Freak it up, add your own ideas. What I think is going to happen is people will be provoked by some of the ideas here. If they have a better idea or a nuance or even a third idea that would even be another idea that would accomplish even a better goal. So for today, if you have a question about the content, or just clarifying, you can do that. If you have a specific amendment, I think we should hold off those till Thursday. I'll do my amendments today so you'll know what order I want the bill to be in. But as always, I'm eager to have the advice of the division to see where you want to go. If the bill isn't kind of thought to be reasonably sensible, it won't pass the Senate either, and this will all be for naught. So, okay. First thing about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess one of the concerns I would have with that provision, I understand where you're going with it, but the way I read it, and maybe you can correct me, in Subdivision 1 is that we're actually adding a mandate back in. And so on our quest to relieve Minnesotans a small amount of Minnesotans of mandates, I guess that would be a concern of mine, is that we're adding on to what is already a heavily mandated system.
Well, that's fair. I just want to mention that I'm not stuck on the mandate part, but and you're not on the policy committee.
No.
But see, I stole this from my medical assistant bill. There's a bill that if you do this in medical assistance, the quality is better and it saves money. Mm-hmm. There's been quite a bit of testimony and quite a bit of buy-in from other groups, so and the plans don't do it. I'm just kind of wondering why. And so maybe they'll agree to look into it and do it, and I'd be happy doing that. So.
But and Mr. Chair, I think that's very fair. I mean, that's the whole purpose for this is cost containment. But at the same time, we all know that the more and more mandates we stack on top are seen to add to the cost. And so I guess I understand where you're going. I just have concern over the mandated language.
Yeah, fair enough. You and a few people in the audience, I should just point out. Fair enough. Okay, let's talk about the purchasing authority. I need to, what I did, there's a bill out, it's a David's bill, and I need to do an author's amendment on this, on section 12. So if I go to page 12, on subdivision 3, it's going to be a little choppy here, so if you have a pen, you'll want to mark this up. On line 29, you're going to keep purchasing authority shell, and you're going to strike the rest of the line. Convene a panel of health care policy is out. Is that there? On line 30, experts are out. He wants those. Experts 2 is out. Keeping established a process 2, and then striking select evidence based. I'll read it back to you when I'm all done. Line 31, select guidelines based on sound research evidence and...
Sure.
And then line 32, strike using these guidelines. And line 33, strike and coverage design. And what we'll do, we're going to get you a new article one, I think, just because we've taken so many things out of it, so they'll be available next time. The sentence should read, the purchasing authority shall establish a process to implement an innovative approach for state government purchasing decisions. So that's, and then also we're going to take out subdivision 4, subdivision 6, those are on page 13, subdivision 8, okay. And here's the idea of this, and I don't want to get too much into the policy of this, it hasn't been heard in the House, I think it's got a lot of merit. And I just took out some of the parts that are around secure benefit sets, and this is, it's just a little preliminary to where I was, where we're going. And I didn't, if we're not ready for some of these ideas, we're not ready for secure benefit sets today. I'll tell you that right now. I can read this audience. But so I think the idea about the purchasing alliance and the state kind of centralizing some of its functions, that's what this is about. I was very much like testimony from the audience and from members about their views about how they see the amended version of this bill working as something to go forward. I hate to say study this, you know, too, but something that I'd like just to do. So that's the thought of that. Any quick reactions from members about that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The stuff that you struck, that's not mandating that the state take any particular action, right? That's to have these things actually done, to come up with the benefit set, what's done with that,
right,
and the language here is...
Well, not
us later, right?
Oh, yeah. What I tried to do is just keep the skeleton of the state doing some bulk purchasing for a lot of things together, and not making them buy anything just yet or develop anything just yet.
And
is that clear? Or did I not answer?
No. I think you're answering a different question. My question is, I kind of like the idea of some of the stuff that you struck.
Oh.
And it doesn't strike me that you're requiring anybody to do any, you know, necessarily do anything with a secure benefit set, but at least we would go start down that path to develop something.
Yeah, if you do a secure, the secure benefit set is a, there's, you need way more language in this to do it, I think. And we've not said for who it's for, it's just a, I'd rather just not do secure benefit. I've got two bills that talk about it that aren't in this bill. And, I think we get purchasing pools and stuff going, and I appreciate that. So we'll, but I think that less people are comfortable than you are about going forward. With that. So that's my view for now, anyway. If we decide different, we'll just reinstate it and amend it, put it back in. Anyway, so that's the purchasing alliance, the purchasing authority.
Did we go over Section 11, Mr. Chair? The transfer of HMO regulatory responsibilities.
Oh, I missed it. Oh, sorry, I just skipped over. And this is controversial, I guess, and I don't know why, and I know the House is like it better than the Senate, and there's some issues about it. This is also part of the Bradley bill, which I tried to incorporate as many features of that as I could here. And it has to do more with the idea about putting things together and having common functions. And I think that if people have different opinions on the committee, I think individuals rather just hold those off until later. I'm not married to this. It just makes some efficiency sense to me. If there's a reason not to do it, then I think we'll vet that out later. Is that okay? Do you want to comment about it?
I just didn't know why we were... Well, okay. I didn't understand the rationale.
Okay, well, there'll be people who say it's a good idea, and you can listen to them and see if you agree or not. I kind of think if you don't agree, it's not going to go forward. So just what I think.
Is that true of everything?
Well, you represent, each of us represents a certain body of people.
So,
and, you know, I think that you'll recognize this is a microcosm of the legislature up on this division here. So that's, anyway, let's move on. This next thing, Article 2, page 14, is this hospital infection deal. And I'm not convinced this is the right language. Section I'm not convinced this is all the right language, but I would like to begin the process of this. There's a way to do this and a way not to do it. I don't want to do it bad. I don't want to do it unfairly. I want to reference the national efforts that are underway, but I want to get us going in that direction. At the risk of doing more studying, I want to get somebody doing something to move us along. And I don't want to embarrass any hospitals that have particularly hard cases or have reasons to have more infections, but there is some things that you can generalize where there's better and worse practices. And if we expand the adverse event reporting network or whatever, but I think there seems to be a will to do something like this, and I was surprised how high this was in my feedback on the division. And so I didn't want to ignore that. So help me through this thing. I don't want to do harm, but I want to move the ball forward. Okay. Section 2, let's see, section 1, section... Oh, actually, there's a whole bunch more about infections. That's the section 1. Section 2, what these were... The way these page into the sections, you'll see that there's different references. I thought section 1 or 2 were all the same. Section 2 is a different deal, but there's more of it later coming on because of how the chapters of law track. So it's organized by chapters of law. The idea of this has to do with some of the no-fault work. And this will be controversial to this committee, and I don't want to dialogue much about it. I just want to explain the idea so you can then think about it. Feedback with some understanding of what I intend as an author. You know, this has to do with fraud investigations through the Department of Commerce. There's, I think, a person and a half who works there doing this. And I'm trying to make sure that they really investigate fraud. So it's a tall person and a short person. But anyway, so there's 1.5 FTEs they have. And there's plenty of fraud to find. And I think I can't think of anybody who's in favor of it. And there's been episodes where different providers have been discovered to be fraudulent, and the board has been all for sanctioning them severely, and some are in jail, and some of my colleagues are in jail, and they belong there. And we're glad that they got caught, because it's wrong. It doesn't have anything, and it's not about that. There's a fragment of every profession that you want to just kind of keep the clamps on. However, there are some things that look funny. Under Medicare, if I bill wrong, that could be considered fraud and subject to a $2,000 fine per error. Or per fraudulent act, which could be using the wrong code. And so I don't think about it much, but it's a terrifying place to be. There are some things that look like they're bad, but they're not fraud. They're just stupid, or they're just ignorance, or they're a bad procedure or a bad training on the part of the licensees who don't know better. And when those are, if those are brought, this amendment says that if you're going to suspect fraud, check with the board, see, is this really fraud? Or is this just something you want to do a little more, require an hour per year of training on how to properly code? And so, and the point of it would be that the board would join arm in arm, along with the commerce people, and really put the hammer on this person, and force him out of business, sanction him severely, take his license away or her license away, and really kind of put the continue to show the power a board can have. I still don't like getting letters from my board. You know, it's like happy birthday cards. You don't know what's in there. It's like the IRS, and they're sending back you a check, and like you're afraid it's an audit thing, you know. That's how the boards are. And you could use that power in a good way to duplicate and even expand the power of commerce. They could do, even as they got together working, that's the idea of this. And so that's the, and so if there's a way to take that and to put it into reality, it'd be better. Calling the boss about the fraud department. Anyway, so that's that, and help me out with there. What I'm after in no-fault issues, is, in particular, is the outliers. Because the people in the, for sure, the group below 80 percentile, they're the ones doing quality care, and you want them around. The ones above 5%, the top 5%, we're spending some money there. And not necessarily getting bad quality, but maybe not getting what we're paying for. Section 3, is this my favorite section here? Is this the Cassidy Memorial section here? And I do want to point out that I took the Wilkin bill in here without telling him. I took the Knobloch bill without telling him. I took the Finstad bill, improved upon it, and at the request of the PBMs, didn't give the commissioner a big hammer. But apparently there was an agreement that this wouldn't go forward now. And so because the pharmacist came to me and said, we had an agreement, please don't do this. And out of respect for the severe lobbying on the part of the PBM guys, I can't take any more calls. I'll tell you people how tough you were. and that this is all going to come out. So if we'll delete section three, how far does that go? All the way down, so all of page 16, all of page 17, all of page 18, all of page 19, down to line 35 on page 19. Is that all of it? Mr. Cassidy, you know if that was all of it. If I missed any, I'll apologize. I just want to point out, though, that what they told us, and I listened, I learned quite a bit at the table as people were just talking to us. What I was told is that if there's weight disclosure between the covered entity and the TDM, and that they pretty well informed what they want to know, and we can comment later, not today. And so a lot of this language is, let them know what you said you tell them. And so I hope that's part of the dialogue, because it's one of the principles that I really like that Durenberger talked about was make sure there's transparency and a way to track the money. And so that's the intent, and I'm trying to act in good faith here, so I've done that, and so the effort's paid off. And now you can, so let's move on to number six, which is disclosure of charges and payments. This is more of that plan stuff, I think. Isn't that right? Just more plan disclosure. I think it got just broken up in a few spots. Oh, no, this is hospitals. This is a hospital reporting on page 20. And again, I don't want to do any harm here, but I do want people to know what things cost. And just because if you compare a CPT code, doesn't mean that you're having a higher or lower cost provider, because there's a way to bundle CPT codes to make a service. Maybe one group has higher priced CPT codes, but they use less of them. You know, different procedures, they don't bill for every aspirin or something, or they don't bill for every touch someone does. And some people have lower prices, but they bill for more touches. And so in the aggregate, you'll then see how this particular group billed. And so that's something that I think that we should know. And I'm very happy to talk to the hospitals about how to make this fairly done. After, there's no gotcha going on. I want to make sure it's apples to apples. Because when you have the IT team calling up, and it's a matter of 50% different, that can't be true. And if it is true, then we should know. So it's just disclosure. And I think done well, this would protect people from IT reports and would help people know what things cost. And so maybe when people are going in with their $50 copay, they realize they got a $24,000 benefit, they'll be glad about that. Any questions about that? Okay. Section 7, which is evidence-based, the bulk of this, there's some tweaks, and I'll point out the tweaks as best I can recall them. A lot of this came from the report from the Department of Health, and you'll see on the next page we have those criteria. Subdivision 4 on page 22 is a really good bunch of criteria. It sets a standard which I think that will stand the test of some time. I'm sure we'll improve upon it with the legislature. I don't want to put into statute any evidence-based guidelines. I do want to put in place an urging toward them, and people who should talk about them and how they might be applied or give people authority to use them. But I do fear rationing, and I want to preserve quality. And what you see here is my effort to keep it from being centralized in any one place, and yet well done and with a lot of inclusion. And I think rather than read it to you now, I'll let you read it yourself, and you can see what's there. And like on line 20, on page 21, line 4, you'll see physician designed as opposed to somebody dropping them in, and at least that's part of the influence there. Performance. You'll see that on subdivision 2, which is line 20, page 21, I'm not interested in having a single nonprofit corporation, just so you know. I think that we want to not limit ourselves to one group. I think there's too much chance of a well-intended but biased approach there. I think you want to have multiple quality done based upon guidelines, evidence-based systems. And we a testimony when the fellows are here, I forget that doctor's name, but he was really smart about this. It was clear that you could have, as long as you have evidence-based, you could have two different systems that went about opposite ways to accomplish the same goal. Not so different than Apple and Microsoft. You know, evidence-based. Microsoft is the best, though, especially if you have stock, you know. But it turns out you want the the Apple group to come forward as well, and the alternative approach, which may actually create a better outcome all in all. So I think as long as you stick with these strict criteria about how to get it, that they haven't got some axe to grind or some investment interest at stake, which is ruled out in those standards, but I think you'll have some good quality. When you get down to 22, on page 22, line 22, you have what the commission might promote. This is an additional list, and the Senate's on some of the same language. I think this is safe. I don't know if it's a good idea. I put it here because I want to show, want to start moving the commissioner toward that. Just to help us, I want to make sure that's well done. So I'm just pointing out my person. I want to be comfortable with that. Help me through that part. And you'll see that the because actually we're going to start applying these into purchasing decisions, and I don't want to trap us into decisions that we're not happy with a long ways down the road, where we're putting these things too much into stone. A discovery is, I want the doctors and the clinicians across here to be eager to research and try new ideas that might be a better way. And if the better way doesn't get discovered because people are stuck with these systems that we set up that helped make sense 10 years ago, that's not a good syntax, but it made sense 10 years ago, we will lose some discovery that will be the breakthrough to save someone's life, to save a lot of money, or both. And so in the same way as we get to page 23, as these go on, talking about rewards and so on, you want to be sure if you're the reward developer, and there may be some reward developers in this room, that there's enough flexibility that people can get out of those systems when there's a better way and still not lose fiscally or in terms of being a preferred provider in your group. Any questions or comments about that whole evidence-based thing? And I'm eager for your input about that, and I'm walking with just great caution through this section, but I think that the direction of this is a safe way, but we want to carefully do it.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
21 subdivision 3, health-related boards.
Oh, let me talk about that.
Just expound on that a little bit.
I'm glad you asked. I didn't mean to skip over that. Actually, I wanted to emphasize that. We talked about it. It didn't come up yet on a different topic. Here's the trouble. Who shall be the arbiter of the standard? Should it be a plan? Should it be the chamber? Should it be labor? Should it be commerce, the health department? I think it should just be me. Then I'd trust them. And everybody wants it to be them, because then they'd have confidence that they were well enough done. So who has a hat to judge? And here's the problem in all of this. There are silos in healthcare. Not just between professions, but within professions. Somebody was talking about some kinds of groups. I can't even repeat what they said they were. They're medical providers. They're very specialized, and they do something. And I couldn't even... There were two of them, and they were close, but they were different. And they have a rivalry amongst themselves, and they decide who can do something or other. But there's a rivalry there, and that's not a criticism. That's just how it is. You get into you've sat through all these hearings about different licensures. What can a therapist do? Wound care or not? And who can do what? You don't want these standards to be about market share. And so what I don't think we're at yet is where there's any group of people able to put aside their own biases and say, for the sake of the patient, we should do these things. I should not do anything here, and we should send her to this kind of practitioner and then to that one, which I'm not even connected to. I think we're not there yet. I think where we are is there's some who are that way, but the system is not there. And so as we try to get standards developed by somebody, I don't think the board wants to develop them, but I think they could oversee the development through working groups, maybe the associations, interested parties, providers, and that they could have a hat, a mantle, an authority where they would keep everybody honest, at least in terms of, well, chiropractors. I understand them pretty well. So that they would oversee the development of chiropractic standards for something, whether it be auto or just spinal injuries or care or something. And the therapists already have a book. They're way ahead. I should commend the therapists, physical therapists, for their advanced work. They have a whole book that talks about some very reasonable, sensible standards. and the respiratory therapist and the other ones. And so at least if you know how respiratory therapists approach the thing, what's good care based on respiratory therapy best practice? At least you know if they're practicing well. The plans would know that they've done best practice. And as time went on, as these standards existed in 5 and 10 years and longer, you would see more blending where they would begin to do more sharing. And I think that would be a benefit. And that's why I suggested the boards here, and I made a promise that they made. They don't have to. Some boards want nothing to do with this, and they don't have to do anything with it. But where a board has an interest in overseeing this, I think they should be given the freedom to do it. And then they report what they did. And we'd say, that's interesting. And there's a board could do this now. They don't need the authority, but they like to be told about the authority so they could be free to go ahead and bring in their various groups. So, reactions. I mean, if you want to react to the table about that on Thursday or next week, I'll be happy to do it. If you want to talk about it in private, please, I'm all ears. Okay, so that's that. Let's move on to Section 8. Oh, back to the boards again. And I think as I've read this over, I don't know that this is the excessive claims going to a board for scrutiny. This is all part of the no-fault idea. And just to be frank, this is about chiropractors and therapists and people who see people on an ongoing basis for somebody's care injuries. I don't think there's a lot of medical issues about this. But in terms of, I've sat through the no-fault debates, there's a problem with outliers. And so how do you handle it? And so the way you handle them now is you take them to court, and it becomes a dance, and then and it's just a lot of money. It occurred to me, and this still needs some work, I think, but there may be some kernel of value in it, that if the board was headed with the authority to in particular a couple of boards, we could single out which ones make the most sense. If the authority to review a case, and like in pornography, you know, you can't define it, but you know when you see it. That they'll know excess when they see it. They could even define it, or they wouldn't define it. They would just judge something to be excessive. The other avenues are still available to the insurance company if they want to take them. Should the board find that there's nothing that they want to act on, they could still do their normal thing, which they do anyway. But that way, if the board did rule something was excessive, then in this version, there's not even an appeal. The board decides, and that's it. So there's it's done, and they can't bill it. The charge is forbidden, etc. So, okay, any questions about that? So if you have any thoughts about that, I'd appreciate it. But this is my positive way of trying to help out the real no-fault issues, which is not your 40th percentile provider, but the upper one. Yeah.
Just a point of clarification. A complaint goes to the board, a board in general, is that something that's and the board makes a decision, is that something that's appealable?
Not under this language, I just gave them power.
No, I'm saying they must deal with complaints, other complaints that aren't here.
Oh, they do other stuff too.
Right, and I'm asking.
Are those appealable?
Yeah.
I don't know. That's a good question. We can ask them when they come. They'll be stopping by, you can be sure. You put someone in a bill, they'll stop by and talk to you. Okay, executive consultation number 9. This is a version of the Goodwin bill. And again, this is disclosure and transparency. And this is not the for-profits. If you're for-profit, you figure that you're out to make some money. If you're not-for-profit, that implies a certain altruism. And maybe 20 is the right number, maybe it's too low, it's too high, 200,000 is not a good number. This is not about people, it's about positions. I don't want to know the names. Anyway, if this is too controversial, it won't last anyway. So it's just there, a little food for thought. That's some piece of mice, this one, so it made one standard, but it may not make another person's standard.
No.
Okay. So much for that. Websites. Article, section 10, page 25. This has to do with trying to get some wellness stuff going. And in my list of proposals, there was way more, a lot of emphasis on trying to get the website beefed up, the MinnesotaHealthInfo.org, so it becomes, the more you work on it, the more it becomes a destination for people. If it's full of good information for employers about health plans, if it's full of information about preventative stuff, it'll become something people use more and more. And so I'm trying to build on that, trying to build on one of the other existing things. There's a whole bunch of things they would list there. Napa Research is number 7 on line 23. If people want to give away their good crutches that they don't want anymore, maybe the hospital wants some of the use for their uncompensated care. So we'll try to nick that from, and so this will solve Hennepin County's problem if we get some free crutches donated. Cancer drug, the cancer drug repository, I put that in here just that it's passed out of civil law. And just so you know, if there's a bill in here we do carry forward, it will be carried forward in its most recent form after the last meeting worked on it. So this is not the last version. So that's quite lengthy. That goes on and on. And I think that takes us all the way up to line to page 32. And I think that section 12 on page 32 is a bunch of that hospital infection business. And when you combine that with the previous section, that's why I want you to tell me where we've gone too far, where it's adequate, and start a process. I don't say that it's a 5-year process, but then push the start button and let it kind of work through. So it carries to a conclusion. I think we'll have gained something about that. Hospitals don't need undue burden. I'm not trying to do that to them. So. That goes all the way into page 34. And I'll give you a clue that the rulemaking on line 24 and 25 will not survive this committee because they're not going to go to Gov after this bill. So if there's rules you want, you want statutes and authorities, we'll give them to you here. We're not going to do rulemaking. That just was a kickoff, I think, on the con bill partly. Any questions about that? Okay, section 13.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I would also say subdivision 6 may run into the same problem.
Or advisory committee. Yeah, so we'll see. And if we have to go there, we'll see if we can get it through. And if it makes sense to do that, this section needs a lot of work. So I appreciate that. And so maybe some of us can work on that or with the Representative Khan or something and try to see if there's a way to talk to the hospitals and give me a plan. And if there's volunteers for that, work on that. Yeah. If there's a volunteer, let me know. Section 13, uncompensated care. This is meant to be friendly. This is meant to be clarifying. And I was going to get language from somebody who was going to drop them off, but I didn't get language yet from one of the hospitals. This is a placeholder. I think we should have a way to clarify what we're talking about. I don't want to cause any harm to the hospitals that are doing uncompensated care. I just want to know when they say that word, what we're talking about. There's uncompensated care, there's charity care, and they aren't necessarily the same. And so I'm looking for clarification. Give me what you want. That way we can talk the same language. Because otherwise what happens is, it's actually bad for the hospitals. Because somebody says, oh yeah, that includes bad debt. And then your whole point's gone. And so tell us what you really have, and that's that. Section 14, which didn't do as well as I thought in the House. This is the ambulance liability coverage. I thought it would get out of civil law. I thought this was the lowest bar of malpractice, of liability issues. And people know I'm not a fan of that. But this is one I thought had some common ground that we could support. Perhaps we yet can. It didn't get heard in civil law, so if this stays in, we'll have to go on a little trip, and I'm not sure we're going to go to civil law. So if you all really like it, if you all like it well enough, we'll take it to civil law if you can get it passed to do the ambulance conformities. So anyway, health improvement, section 15. This is wonderful language. This is how to get grants and health promotion without any money at all. And so the commissioner and good people are going to go looking for money from non-state sources. Is that this is the one, isn't it? Yeah, public or private sources. We're going to find grants, get a local match, and do wonderful things with it. And anyway, so we have no target. Did you get the idea? There may be some use for this, and if you can find a way to make this useful so it does good things, and if not, it's cute. And the next section is more substantive. And just, you know, if you have the money line, section 15 could be a good one to bring forward, but given the structure we're in, that would just possibly be healthcare access fund or something, but that's not that open for rating these days, apparently. Anyway, section 16, trying to be practical, and I got feedback from this, trying to get some wellness promotion going here and trying to get stuff done with no money, way to be kind of creative. The local community health boards, they're everywhere. Every section, every county has one at least, and some have more than one, I think. But there's no end of providers who would, if you ask them, would go off and do classes at schools. They would consider it to be a joy to go. I've spoken to a lot of schools, and it's really just a hoot. They and I think that if they put their mind to this, they could even do some very good education and wellness work. The best work you can ever do in healthcare is not need the work to be done. If you get these kids, if it becomes cool to be healthy and make good choices on all kinds of levels, it catches on. You could pass out T-shirts, or I mean, local clinics would pass out. I keep well at this XYZ clinic, and if I go there anyway, and maybe they'd be a fad, and people would, you know, they could put their minds to some work here, and I think there's somewhere to go with that. So, the reaction to that, spellbinding, right? Trying to move along here. Section 17 is just a technical thing, and I think that the bill that got put in was drafted. Not how I would have had it done. This is only clarifying that the usual and customary is the pharmacy's own usual and customary. If this is a problem, let me know. It's meant to be almost technical. So, and that section 18 is also meant to be just a happy face, no cost thing for pharmacies. And if I could have mail orders do it, I would, but I don't know if they can. Where they just put at their sites some of these brochures about the free programs. That since people who are shopping for drugs might go there, and I think the pharmacist would like to help people out a little bit there. They wouldn't, well, anyway. I'll tell you the problem, and if pharmacies don't want to do it, I'll tell you the problem. The area agencies on aging, say that 10 times, are doing this. The Senior Federation, AARP, are not helping with this, and I don't know why. They're going to be embarrassed and they're helping now. But these should be promoted. And they have people that they're looking after that need to know about these programs. And they're waiting to be accessed. I think the number is 20,000. And I don't want to, it doesn't make sense. We're not getting that out more. So the Section 19 is the no-fault version of the board's doing standards. And that this may not be a good idea. I may not necessarily given what we did before. It just kind of fit the bill. I was working on it. It may be deletable. It's all part of that same discussion. Section 20, I need to hear from the different boards and about this. This may already be done, but it is the name of disclosure. I had one thing where we published people with malpractice verdicts. This is simply making sure that the boards know about that without any need to act. And I don't know if this is already done, but my desire was that if there's a bell curve of providers, and the rap is, whether it's valid or not, is that some groups don't want to go after their own bad providers. We don't want bad providers. We're all against them. And so the boards decide their own standards and criteria of what they deem to be valid and invalid. If they don't have the data, they won't know. If they have the data, this is moot. But there should be a level of convictions that go that way, and malpractice convictions and or settlements. And so I'll find out what, and I know that I've been asked to talk to somebody about that already, and they'll give us some more news. The directory on Section 21, more disclosure. I don't know what's reasonable to put in here, if malpractice convictions are sensible to put here or not, if it's fair. I know we have in Massachusetts, they had some directory, at least where you went to school, how long you've been in practice, etc. I think that would benefit people to know that you've been in practice for 49 years or 2 years, and that you're board certified in four things or one thing, because you never know. And I think it's there's a reason that people get those credentials, and that would give them the reward for having done that. No criticism against people who don't have those credentials. That way, it would just be disclosure. See how long that one lasts. Okay. Severability. I think that's a... is there some humor that severability clause is severed from the rest of the session? I think that's... at least Section 22 should be out. Okay. Moving along here, any questions about Article 2? We're not doing too bad here. There's a statewide action plan here. I think this is self-explanatory. Section 2 is a study using the boards and so on. It's, I'm trying to be, this along with other no-fault parts is my answer to the no-fault problem. I think to repeal no-fault is editorializes an error, personally. I think it gets at the wrong people and causes a huge shift in my division. So I think it's not a good idea. And I'm sure Medicare wants to pay the extra money to cover all those costs. It'll just go back on the employers, which I think is a negative thing. But at least this will be a way to study some of these matters with people who are have a hat to study things. There's been a few work groups going on. Their hats that they hold are apparently too small to hold weight. So with all this is, I think, a group that would actually have some weight and some substance that could actually get at the problem and point out who the problem is, and I think that would be interesting. Section 3. This is actually not unrelated to the Purchasing Alliance kind of things and the Smart Buy Alliance and the governor's effort in the cabinet work, so related to that. Any questions? Section 4 is a bunch of studies, and I hated to make them studies, although the Department of Health has left. You might have read this section that they're taking it out of their current funds, which is on the bottom of page 40 and the top of page 41. Because I've got a fiscal note here, so there's and we'll talk about which of these make some sense. I wanted to put a lot of ideas out there, so if we can find some ways to help keep the health cabinet busy, or really might not be busy enough, we wanted to have them look into some things. Let's see. And I think I think the first part's kind of preamble. We make them consult with relevant parties, and I guess not with irrelevant parties. That would be line 24 on page 40. And they would, on line 41, they'd be studying quality of care issues, on different stuff. Section small b on line 19 is looking at more alternative and complementary areas. I think there's a lot of mileage to be gotten from there. Electronic records, and on paragraph C, I suggest that we tell somebody to get going and to tell us what standard we want to use so we can all hook up on the right system. I have no interest in any portfolio of mine, as small as they are, in anybody's plan. But on page 41, paragraph C, the last sentence there on line 27 and 28 is, please tell us what one makes sense. We have, well, you all represent many people who are investing tens of millions of dollars in systems that do not talk to each other. And I hope there's an interface that you can buy later that will get you hooked into the rest of you. The same thing happened with VCRs when they had the beta. You know, sorry if you bought a beta, I'm sorry about that. And now that they're gone too, but mini discs and anyway, so it's time for that. And then paragraph D is about electronic billing. A lot of small providers, including me, can't get that electronic billing thing figured out with the state. And it's supposed to be easy, and I keep pushing my staff, they can't get it figured out. And there's got to be 1,000 or more, or 5,000 people in little clinics of whatever kind across the state who would love to get done with paper on the state plans in particular, and there might even be a way to help. And so we're saying, please help them. And it saves money to the state and to the providers if they do go electronic. And at least as I understand, section subdivision 4, which is the bottom of line 41, page 41, talks about looking at the 24/7 health disparity population. And in my, there's some ideas we've got coming forward in the state work about some of that. I believe, and there's no mandate here, you'll see, but it occurs to me that if some of the hospitals and the plans would find ways to set up 24/7 clinics, especially in some of these areas where there's a lot of use of ERs for inappropriate reasons, I think the system saves money. You have better quality because there are people they would recognize, a smaller setting, less urgent attitude around there, and I think better outcomes. So that's my, you don't see a mandate there, so that's when the drive's gone. But you see a talk, let's talk about it and find a way to do it. And also I suggest you might want to find a way in section 4, paragraph 4 of that on page 42, that if you can use some of the different categories of practitioners there, PAs, nurse practitioners, interns, residents, other kinds of allied professionals that might make some sense at the right time. You might be surprised at some of the ways that you can get some better quality care injected into some of these very poor health outcome populations for almost no money. We had the U of M students came and said they couldn't afford to have their patients go to you because the Minnesota care was cut down to $500. I would assure you that those students would love to go to work in one of these clinics under proper supervision, where it's already set up and it's closed at night, and you set up a clinic there for almost no money, or you bill at the regular rates and see what comes. There's ways to do it, and this is just trying to be innovative, and so it's not a mandate, it's a suggestion. Any questions about that? Okay, then there's some studies about cost. And this number one under cost on page 42, line 15, this has to do with these forms. I think this is the universal, like the HICFA and the reporting. Some people say we're done, some say we're not done. I don't know if we're done or not, but if we're done, then they'll tell us that we're all universal. If there's still areas that aren't, I think it makes sense to get there. Number two has to do with online verification of coverage. And I think that the plans, Minnesota health plans, are ahead of the curve on a lot of this stuff. I think the self-employed are way behind the ERISA plans. And I think it's very difficult for their clients. And I think that can go better. But I think it's a need. But I'm just saying that from a provider point of view. I could be, there could be some aspects that they're way ahead of them on. And I'm just trying to be clear here with what I'm trying to get at. Paragraph B is a real issue, a grave issue. If this is not solved, people must die. And so I'd like them to look into the matter of the interpreters. And this has to be tweaked up. This is not the language that's in the... This is meant to be language that I had in my bill and it needs to be improved upon. And we'll have an amendment to broaden that out to the hearing impaired as well. This is to talk about it. And I think the answer about what is it the providers cover it is not a satisfactory answer. I think this is a partnership on how do we do it, and maybe we can find a way to do a... There's some telephone thing you can call and get a dial-in interpreter, which wouldn't work for the hearing impaired. but there may be some other way to go with that. So, but I think it needs to be discussed as opposed to just having us be silent on it. And some would prefer that, but I think we should talk about it. Section 5 is the Emmer language about the medical malpractice report. I don't know if this takes it to civil law, but I think for all the med-mal stuff and how little that stuff went forward for all the time we spent in the health committee on it, at least if we could have some data we agree on so we can talk about it in an up-and-down way, at least so people don't get their own facts. You know, you have an opinion, but not your own facts. Any questions about that? Seeing none, the health coverage reinsurance... Oh, this, actually, we're more done than we think. This is probably the last big thing. The timing is going perfectly. This is something I think we need to put some energy into, and this just has to do with a reinsurance pool, and how do you go about getting that going? Well, RCRA, we know there's also the kind of defunct, the insurance association. I would suggest that we look into reactivating that as not as a state-run entity. And the point being to provide self-insurers, in particular, a reinsurance pool to tap into, or the teachers, or the co-ops, or even the plans if they wanted to tie into there, or Prudential if they want to come back to Minnesota, or whoever, to create a market. I have an impression that this wouldn't do very much good or bad to the plans as they exist now. That's my impression. I think it would do a great deal in the self-insured market to help employers control their costs. It seems to me like the big challenge in trying to self-insure yourself is the reserve fund and the self-insurance piece. And so if we can create a real market in that, and it seems to make sense if we would even use the RCRA reserves as a temporary cash flow fund, but they'd be partitioned and not put at risk. So whatever reserves there would be there, but you just use it as a cash flow thing, the state would still back it, I think, as the final stop loss insured with the state. I got to think, and even for malpractice, I got to think that if we charge, and this is my view, and I'm telling you clearly what I think so you can tell me where I'm wrong. If we charge docs and ER docs, OBs, whoever, use this as our backing, charge them the same price they're paying now for malpractice and kept them flat for a couple of years, we could guarantee that, I think, and we'd make a ton of money. The reinsurers are, that they use are casualty reinsurers. They're paying for Hurricane Hugo, 9/11, and bad investments. And so this would have no such bad experience because it's new. And so we'd have real rates based upon what it really costs. And I think we'd find a way to contain the malpractice crisis in a Minnesota way. Right now, we're told the malpractice issue is not so bad for the reinsurer, for these, some of the docs, because they found a place to go. They're going offshore. And so they're implying that they were employing Bahamian clerks and technical staff, or wherever they went, and not Minnesota state employees, or whoever we have here. And these would be good jobs. These would be real jobs by Minnesotans, taking care of Minnesota people with Minnesota risk. And I think it provides somewhere to go. And it's only a study, and they would be able to talk about it. If I were the king, I would say, let's just do this thing. But I think it needs to be looked at, and it would be probably a little quick to do that before the session is over. But I think there's a real huge possibility here where nobody loses. Because the reinsurers don't want to come to Minnesota anyway. And who the reinsurers are right now is the self-insurers having their own self-insured. And they buy some of the reinsurers from Florida or somewhere. And I'm using Minnesota reinsurers. So nobody gets hurt that I know. And I think there's somewhere to go on here, and I hope that we can flesh this out in particular in this group. And if we do nothing else with this, this would be huge. Because as we establish our reserves by keeping some normal prices, and there'd be a board that the governor would appoint to run the state thing, and we'd be independent. I mean, the legislature would not be messing with this. So they'd be a real insurance group. And the beneficiary would be the state people who use this thing. And so if we're flat now, I could imagine we even reduce rates someday when we build up our reserves. And the beneficiaries would be the working people of Minnesota who actually get a raise instead of having to pay it all in their health insurance. And the employers who could offer better plans. And then further we might offer, if self-insurers want to take advantage of this, they just have to opt into the Minnesota stuff. The co-ops tell me that they have all the mandates anyway, and their prices are competitive. So that's something we discussed. A little provocative, perhaps, but maybe a good way to end the day. Just to finish up, Article 4 is pretty much House File 2023. And I don't know if Logan wants that kept in here or not, but it's here. I don't think there's any changes to that from how it is on the floor, with the exception of the deletion of that part I didn't like. It's my bill. About that, the disclosure, where there's a federal law about who can, about release of records and so on, about patient approval. I'm troubled by that part, and that's not a surprise. So it's not in my bill. It's still in the Wilson bill. There's no repealer in there, should it pass. But if this goes forward in this bill, and I don't know if it's going to, if Wilson wants it, I'll just take it out. I'm trying to do him a favor and give him another place to get this language passed, because I think the plans wanted this language. I think it was a cost containment for the, a lot of the, that's what they were telling me anyway, that it was a positive, came out of commerce and health, that it helped them try to reduce costs. What we do have to do yet is to finish the clean claim language, which is still in the process. I don't know if this is even, the same amendments that came out of committee, I don't know, it's supposed to. Well, not bad, 604. I think I covered everything, at least in a pretty quick announce over. Any questions from members?
There is a fiscal note?
I don't know. No fiscal note. Oh, but we do, and the fiscal staff will look through. I don't get a fiscal note. If there is, we can't do it. There will. In one language, I need the department to get out of available funds. That's it. And just so you know, and I think that's not a bad practice in the short term of this. If we have real money, we'll have to get leadership to use the money in the conference time to get a target if we agree we have a target. But to everything leave the floor, not knowing what the Senate might even take of these, makes no sense to allocate money for what might not happen. That's my view. Just to give you really what's going to happen, we should meet Thursday again sometime. Members, please, I need your input on this. I need to know where I'm crazy, where I've got some good ideas. Please mark it up. If you have thought of other ideas, I intend to have no more ideas to this from me. I think this is enough from one person. I think I've listened to the ideas. I think you see some of your thoughts coming to here. Members, if you have other ideas you want to bring forward that this has provoked, I'm open to that. Normally not just a raw idea. We can get it put in the language. We'll meet Thursday sometime, either during committee hour or nominally at 4:30 again, since that time. There's a session on Thursday. I don't know what's happening in session. If you want to come to talk to me personally, members of the audience, or members of the division, please do. Emails are very effective. Personal marked up copies, we have a ton of these around. You can take yours and mark it up. I want to know what you think. And with that, we're adjourned. That's 5.